Warming temps and heavy rains can spell trouble for your home. Don't wait for a problem. Get a free foundation inspection from PermaSeal. Stay dry, stay protected. For peace of mind, call 800-421-SEAL or visit permaseal.net.
Welcome to this edition of Steve Bertrand on Books. I'm glad you're here. You know, Dr. Ashley Alker has 100 stories in her new book, and 99 of them are about the different ways we die. The 100th is the most touching, and Ashley will be along to talk about that. She became a medical professional after her mother became seriously ill, and she wanted to help her family translate the jargon of the hospital into a language that a frightened family might understand. Serious stuff, right? Well, not completely. The book's actually a lot of fun. 99 Ways to Die and How to Avoid Them. Also, amidst the grief and fright that has come out of Minnesota at the hands of ICE and others, comes a resurgence of a 1940s children's book series. Really?
90% of the people might not have heard of these books, and then the others that have just had their world rocked by hearing them spoken aloud.
We'll learn more about that coming up in the podcast, but let's start with Dr. Ashley Alker and her unconventional bedside manner.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Sure. So I said I enjoyed and had fun reading this. Was that the point, or am I horribly mistaken?
No, you got the point. I think that the point of the book is to be entertaining and engaging and to give you scientific evidence-based information at the same time. So I want you to have fun or at least be entertained while reading it. There are some serious topics in there, but you know, I try to write it in a way that uses humor to take the fear away.
I think you succeeded. I want to start a little more serious, though, because I want to read your dedication. It was only two sentences, and it was beautiful, and I think it fueled the book. She wrote, "For my mother, Kathleen Marie Alker, this was the hardest part of the book to write because you were everything." Tell me about that.
Yeah. She was. She was my best friend. She was obviously my mom. She, you know, we don't realize how important sometimes those people are in our lives until they're taken away. And I was lucky that I did realize it while she was alive. I knew she was my best friend. We talked several times every day. She was my person. And so, you know, she was one of the reasons that I went into medicine initially. My family is very distinctly non-medical. We're a family of business people and one circus performer, as I write in the book. And my mom, unfortunately, had lymphoma shortly after I was born and was told she had 6 months to live. Mm. They did something called mediastinal radiation, which is not really done much anymore because it's very caustic. And it caused her to have, she lived, which was great for much longer after that. But she was, I think, 26 at the time. But she had a lifetime of side effects. So she got pulmonary hypertension. She had two open heart surgeries, and she had a brain surgery.
And she fueled your decision to go into medicine and not be a circus performer.
Yeah, basically. I wanted to act as a medical translator for my family. And so I did that. And unfortunately, she died in my last year of medical school and never saw me become a doctor. But I kind of translated that into what I do today, which is trying to be a medical translator for everyone, for my patients, for my readers, anyone who's interested, anyone who will listen. I want to help you understand the science.
Well, I think she certainly felt you being a doctor, right? I mean, you were her caregiver in her last days.
Yeah. I mean, I attended countless, you know, doctor's appointments. I counted pills. I was, you know, very involved in her care. And at that time, I had a degree in public health, so I kind of understood some of it. And so, you know, a degree in molecular biology and public health will get you pretty far in understanding the science, obviously. So that was kind of where I was at along the way of taking care of her before I went to medical school. So I did have some education in the subject, which helps because it is a different language. It's like speaking Spanish or French.
Yeah, and it's hard for medical professionals, I know you know this as well, to distill it into language that I can understand. Right. I mean, that's part of the problem is it's in many ways, if not two different languages, certainly two distinct dialects.
Most definitely. And I think that if you're a polyglot or someone that speaks multiple languages, you know that there's some words in certain languages where there's no translation. And one of the words that Danish friends, when I was studying in France, my best friend was from Denmark, and she had the word hugled, which is kind of like a warm and fuzzy feeling. Yeah. But we don't have a translation for that in English. There's no word for that feeling in English. And so medicine is the same. There are words in medicine that there's no translation for. So you have to find another way to help people understand them.
It's interesting you bring that up. That's one of my daughter's favorite words. She came home from studying abroad, maybe, but she calls it hygge, which is certainly not the Danish version.
No, yeah. But it is. It's the same thing. I mean, a lot of the northern countries have that word. The Scandinavian countries mm-hmm. have that word. And so, you know, that is something that I realized in learning medicine, coming from, you know, a very non-medical background, that I understood I was learning a new language and that I was becoming a translator if I did my job right.
I'll get to death in a minute or two, but you also write something that I had not considered, but it's fascinating. You talk about Charles Darwin and his journey on the Beagle, and you point out that medicine and the advances in medicine and in the world may be circumventing natural selection. Wow.
Yeah. I mean, if you think about it, natural selection doesn't quite work in the same way anymore, right? So it was survival of the fittest and solely dependent on our genes and, you know, those things that we could carry forward. Well, now that selection is, like you said, circumvented sometimes by science. People with weaker immune systems, we can give vaccines to, and it will help them fight the disease. People who maybe wouldn't have survived, we can help now. And we can, you know, they come to me in the emergency department and we find ways to fix it. And so it doesn't work the same anymore. And that's okay. That's why I have a job. So I think we're all okay with that not being, you know, the total driver, but it is still there in a lot of different ways, right? And so I think that it's still a principle, obviously, that exists. It's just modernized.
Okay, so evidence of that maybe is that our life expectancy is actually going down. Now, I would imagine COVID really kicked that number up, right? Or explain that for me.
It did. I mean, life expectancy, you really have to look at a lot of different variables, and you look at different countries and you'll see fluctuations at different rates at different times. And there are obviously reasons for that. COVID brought life expectancy down in general because it was a pandemic, right? But it was somewhat temporary. The vaccine came into play. The virus maybe attenuated a little bit. And now we're at a point where things are better again. I mean, for over a year there, it was the leading cause of infectious deaths and the number two cause of death globally. So whether you believe in it or not, people were dying from it. And that was something that, you know, that probably did have a little bit of, it would have had more effect on our evolution had we not created the vaccine, but we did. And so that's how we kind of change the evolutionary outcomes these days, is by using science. And I think everyone's okay with that because we like living longer.
Well, not everyone is okay with it, apparently. We're learning that. But but even with that, our life expectancy is dropping a little bit.
Yeah. And there are, I mean, that's going to be multifactorial. So a lot of the longevity and wellness stuff, I don't touch on too much in this book because we know the answer to some of these things. They're just things we don't want to do. You need to eat healthy. You need to exercise. You need to get good sleep. You need to not drink and not smoke. And, you know, people are selling you this like it's new every time they, you know, tell you it, but it's something that we know we just need to be better at. And also it's about balance too, right? So, I mean, the issue with longevity probably has a lot to do with our diet and a lot to do with, you know, exercise and a lot to do with our health choices and maybe health access. So there's definitely multifactorial reasons for that. But in my book, I kind of focus on specific diseases that we have a scientific answer for and you can avoid.
You write about this one experiment. I'm sorry to interrupt you there.
It's okay.
That they're putting young mouse blood or old mouse blood into young mice.
Yeah, so that was a really interesting experiment. Yeah. And it works because there are a lot of things going on in our bodies that we kind of don't know about, things like methylation and a lot of different kind of molecular level changes that happen with age. And so this is something that people are trying to solve, but it's definitely not something, you know, if someone's selling you a pill that will make you live forever, it's right. not real. So, I mean, that's one of the other things I'd say be cautious of is, you know, people, charlatans selling you snake oil.
Stephen King, pay attention to this. This sounds like a movie, right? So the clinics where I give my kids give me their young blood and I live forever. I wouldn't take that.
He's my favorite.
Is he?
So, oh yeah, I think he's, I mean, he's just a fabulous writer. His On Writing book is one of my favorites. So, yeah, no, please use, use the science for science fiction, Mr. King.
We're talking about people dying, but there are also people who come back to life that you touch on. Rare, but this is the Lazarus phenomenon. Explain that for me.
Yeah. So at the end of the book, which is kind of the quirky title of The Afterlife, is a short afterword I wrote kind of about my time working in television and film and correcting media in general and trying to get scientific messages across in a way that's correct and evidence-based, but also entertaining and engaging. But one of the things that I touch on in this afterword is that not everything can be explained by science. And, you know, we know that, right? And we're okay with that. There are some things that maybe we're not going to understand, and maybe we're not supposed to understand. And the Lazarus phenomenon is one of those things where a patient is pronounced dead and then comes back to life, and it's really unexplainable. And while a lot of these patients don't do well and do inevitably pass, there are miracles out there. And so I think as humans, we kind of have to understand that we do our best, and, you know, you have to do the work and be smart about things, but also your life is sometimes out of your control, and you have to kind of lean into whatever higher power, whatever purpose you have, whether that's, you know, just making the world a better place, whether that's some form of religion. And so sometimes science doesn't have all the answers, and I'm okay with that too. And I think most people are.
You just scared the heck out of people who have a fear of being buried alive.
Yeah, I'm sure.
But it's very rare, right? It doesn't happen.
It's rare, and it happens pretty immediately. It's not like weeks later. Yeah. It's like an immediate thing usually, like in a department. And we're talking about like a handful of cases across the world over all of time type thing. This is not something that's happening, you know, once a week.
You mentioned being rare. Being an advisor for TV and movies, which is the part of the role of the medical translator. And what is it that they most likely get wrong? TV and movies.
Oh, there's a lot of things. I mean, storytelling is so important to who we are as humans, and it's how we pass on our knowledge. And it sticks, right? You eat carrots because they're good for your eyes, and you get a tetanus shot because rust has tetanus if you step on a nail. Neither of those things are true, by the way. Carrots are good for your eyes if you have a vitamin A deficiency, but that fallacy was created by British Air Force during World War II to trick the Nazis into thinking that their pilots had good eyesight and not radar. And they actually got the U.S. in on it by calling Walt Disney. And he promptly made a cartoon with dancing carrots that told people, you know, these are great for your eyes. You should eat them.
So the idea is the Nazis would eat carrots and not try to develop radar?
Exactly.
Wow.
which is one of our more interesting, I mean, you know, it seems to have worked because they didn't find out about the radar for some time. Tetanus is something that is found in dirt, and dirt is found on rust. So, I mean, just leave that one alone, I guess. But rust specifically has no connection with tetanus. So these stories are very important because they get perpetuated for a very long time. And sometimes they have very critical information to survival. And that's what we can do with television, because it's one of the main ways that we tell stories these days. And so it's a great place to create accurate descriptions of health and science. And one example of this, and I often quote her, she actually is a doctor that messaged me recently and has done some brilliant work in television and film with science. And she showed that if you do CPR correctly versus incorrectly on television, it does affect how people do CPR if they haven't taken a class or don't know anything about CPR. So there's an opportunity for passive education there. And so that's kind of why I got into it, is that I wanted to help tell the correct stories a scientific way. And it makes for better television. People recognize when it's real and when it's fake, even if they don't know the science. You can kind of intuit whether what you're seeing reflects our reality. And a great example of that is, you know, The Pitt. Everybody loves it. It's critically acclaimed. There's several emergency doctors working on that show, and they're doing things extremely accurately, and people respond to that.
I was going to try to resist asking you about The Pitt.
Yeah. Everybody asks me about The Pitt because I'm an emergency doctor. Unfortunately, I'm not working on the show. Call me, John Wells. but yes, Joe Sachs is working on that show, who is an amazing physician, screenwriter, and a producer at this point. But he worked on ER, mm-hmm. You know, the original, or I guess the shows technically aren't related, but you know, that show back in back in the, I think it was the early 2000s or 90s.
Oh, it was before the 2000s. I want to put a little meat though on the CPR bones, because there actually are studies, and you might have said this, but I want to stress it a little bit, that the people who know CPR but get it from TV, actually the patients end up worse off, or not as well, or it hurts, they do it more wrong.
Yeah, exactly. So the study basically
wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you got it though. The study basically showed that if you show someone incorrect CPR, like they're doing CPR on the neck, and or they're doing it at a way too slow rate, or they're, you know, not allowing for recoil, if they're doing it incorrectly, it's far more likely to be like, I guess you could say copied, not emulated, but copied in that way. So that would obviously give you a worse outcome. So they showed people correct and incorrect CPR, and then they said, do CPR on this, you know, fake patient or dummy. And the people that saw correct CPR did a better job.
We're talking to Ashley Alker. She's the author of 99 Ways to Die, and she's seen a lot of it. She's a ER doctor in San Diego. So I'm just tempted to do the fun stuff, but I think we should be a little responsible too. Never ignore chest pain.
Never ignore chest pain. Never ignore stroke symptoms. So one-sided weakness, numbness, vision loss, slurred speech. Never give a baby under 1 year old honey. Never dilute baby formula or give a baby that's under 6 months water. And try and drink water yourself with electrolytes. These are all life-saving, you know, tiny facts, but I tell you why in the book just so that you know, because sometimes we want to know why.
A lot of people go to the emergency room. I know some who've gone with chest pain and they come home and there's like, well, they said it was just gas.
And
right?
That's fine. But you don't know that. You don't know when it's just gas or when it's the big heart attack. And missing it is your life. So it's just not something to mess around with. Chest pain is not something to ignore. If your right foot has been hurting for 6 months, wait for your primary care appointment. But chest pain is just not one of the things that you ignore.
That's so funny. My left foot is hurting when you started that sentence. I'm like, oh my God, really? What am I? No, I'm good. I can stay home.
I knew you were going to try and go.
You write about people who, one of the first questions parents get when they bring their children into the ER is about vaccinations. And we are in a weird vaccination world right now.
We are. And it's sad because most of it's driven by fear and misinformation. And as a new parent, I understand that all you want to do is what's best for your kid, you know, and you want to make sure what you're doing is safe. But you need to know that most of the information out there on vaccines, especially on social media, is fear mongering. It's trying to get you to click, trying to get you to watch, because these days they might not be selling you something overtly, but they are selling you an idea, and your click and your time is the commodity these days. So that follow is all you need to do for that person to make money off of their content. So a lot of times the information you're getting is incorrect because that type of information is more, it's salacious, it's sexy. People want to click on it. It's often novel because it's made up. You know, vaccines have been around for a long time. They eradicated smallpox. They have almost eradicated polio. Over the last 50 years, we've saved 154 million lives, 6 lives a minute for 50 years. And 101 million of those were infants. So vaccines are something that are, you know, in my family, a non-negotiable. My child is vaccinated. And I have the background and the information about it. So look to the people you trust that are educated on the subject. Talk to your pediatrician about it if you have vaccine hesitancy. Talk to your primary care. Don't listen to the internet. They don't have your best interest at heart. Look to the people that you trust.
So what does it happen? How does it happen when someone's wheeled into your emergency room and they just have non-traditional ideas or whacked out ideas, and you're there to make them better? I don't know you well, but I think I can hear your eyes rolling when that happens.
Well, you'd be surprised, because as an emergency doctor, I take my role very seriously, just to partner with you in whatever it is you want to do. So I'm going to give you all the information you need to make the best decision, but then you're going to make the decision. So if you're having a heart attack, I'm going to tell you, look, this is what we do. We give heparin. You should go to the cath lab. But if you say, no, I want to get up and walk out of here, that's okay, because that's your life and you get to decide. So in the emergency department, for me, there's never any eye rolling. There's never, you know, you don't want to vaccinate your kids. That's fine. Let's talk about immunoglobulin. Let's talk about what we can do to try and help you. I'm always there to partner with my patients and to do what they want to do. I just want to give you all the information that I have so you can do it. In my book, I tell you how I feel.
There we go.
That's what the book's for.
You also write in the book, as long as we're talking about children and child care and child raising, about the fourth trimester.
Oh, yes.
Which I don't think I've heard that phrase before.
So the New York Times did a really good article on it some time ago. And basically, it looked at the time just immediately following pregnancy and found that that is actually where we were losing a lot of life of mothers. Is, you know, pregnancy itself is actually very dangerous. There's a lot of, you know, issues that come along with pregnancy and diseases such as certain types of cancer, preeclampsia, pulmonary embolisms, things that are higher risk when you're pregnant, and some things that can only happen to you when you're pregnant, right? And these things are life-threatening. Postpartum cardiomyopathy, these things can kill healthy people. And so knowing about these risks, because you're taking, you know, you're putting your life in your hands by trying to create new life, and making that decision yourself is very important, but also that time after your pregnancy can be very dangerous. And that is because there's a really good quote in the book by a physician a little south of me, who's an MFM physician. And she just said brilliantly, she said, we live in a society where the baby is the candy and the mother is the wrapper. And once we have the candy out of the wrapper, we want to just throw the wrapper away. And we can't do that. We have to realize that the wrapper is a person.
Yeah.
And that's so important, because we live in a society that doesn't support moms. We don't have, there's no childcare backup. We're like, why is there a difference in men and women's salary? Well, one of us has to have a baby and then breastfeed and be present for that. So, that's never going to get fixed until we address it. So, you know, do what you want, but that will never be fixed until we address it as a society.
Okay. I have a daughter who lives in Australia, and she has for 3 years. It's killing me. She's coming back hopefully later this year. Oh, yes. She's lucky to be alive, right? So many ways to die in Australia.
Oh, yes. I mean, Australia, that down under, they take things seriously. But honestly, evolutionarily, I think they just must be tougher than us, because those animals, man, they're pretty. I mean, they have poisonous spiders and snakes and, you know, crocodiles and, you know, all these animals that can be fairly dangerous. But it seems like all the most poisonous animals happen to live in Australia. And I am not exactly sure. You'd have to talk to somebody, a zoologist, about that. Maybe Erwin can
the survivor, yeah, the son.
Yeah, he probably knows.
Well, and his father was killed by an animal in Australia, right?
So yeah, I mean, it is a dangerous. There are a lot of dangerous animals there, but I mean, it also seems to be a wonderful place. I've never been there, but even with all the dangers, I'd love to go.
Well, if you're going to go, let me know. I'll give you some stuff to bring to my daughter, because it's so expensive to ship.
I'm sure.
But you do posit the idea that maybe because it's an isolated island, that it lends itself to more destructive flora and fauna and animals. Explain that for
me. Yeah. So maybe there was some type of evolution of this, right? So like, you know, one animal became more poisonous and then another animal did the same in order to, you know, keep itself safe from the first animal. So there could be a reason for that. But obviously things like marsupials, though, I mean, there actually are marsupials outside of Australia, possums, but generally you think of them just in Australia. And I mean, it's a whole continent and a country. So it had so much geographic isolation.
So one of the times we went down there to visit, we went to a farm where we could, you know, pet wallabies, and I actually held a koala.
Careful with chlamydia.
Right. So I held a koala and did not come home with chlamydia, which
yay!
I didn't realize.
A different kind, but still.
I didn't know I was at risk of, but yeah. So
yes.
The koalas are randy bears, or what's going on here?
So a little bit randy, but also theirs is more of a respiratory illness. It is a different type, but it is related to, you know, obviously the bacteria in humans, hence the same name. But yeah, they actually had a huge outbreak, and it caused an issue in their koala population, where they started to have, they weren't endangered, but there were a threatened species.
And also, this, you know, we patted and watched kangaroos, some with the gangly babies, you know, in their pockets and things. And this one kangaroo started peeing on me, and everyone thought it was funny, but me. No, I'm making that up. But if a kangaroo whips it out, you're in trouble.
Yeah. I mean, that's something that I thought was really interesting when I was researching the book, that the Australian, I think it was like the, it was a governmental organization for the protection of animals. And I was reading about kangaroos and they said, you know, if the kangaroo stands up and, you know, shows you his full height and then starts urinating, that you should back away slowly because this is a sign of aggression. And I can't imagine that anyone does it.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly. That's what I'm thinking.
I can't imagine somebody being like, yeah, he probably wants me to stay.
I'm going to come closer. Right. we're talking to Ashley Alker. She's a doctor and has written 99 Ways to Die. You didn't write about hippos. I thought hippos were a big killer.
Oh, hippos are in Africa. Yeah, they're in
right,
there.
Right, I'm sorry. I've jumped continents. Yeah.
Yes. Hippos are in there. They are a big killer. It's actually surprising because you'd think on that continent, given, you know, the fauna that are there, lions and, you know, leopards and whatnot. But hippos are actually, you know, the most deadly animal aside from mammals.
You did write about that. I missed it. I apologize.
It's okay. Don't worry. You can go back. That's why I wrote it the way that I wrote it, is so you can jump around, because nonfiction can be dry and these subjects can be dense. So I tried to write it in a you can pick it up, put it down whenever you want to type of way.
Some of the things that struck me, a couple of things, was the idea that it's harder to die than we think, or we're less likely to die than we think. And I was really very surprised that only 28 people a year die from lightning strikes in this country. Is it this country, right? Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's one that I think that, you know, we think the other fallacy there is that we think when we're in our cars, everyone thinks that they're insulated by, I think the fallacy is the tires, but it's actually the metal that moves the lightning strike around you, so you can't touch the doors or anything. But if you do get struck, you are unlikely to die, unless generally if it's immediate, it's an issue. You can have a cardiac arrhythmia, and so that would be, you know, the issue that would usually cause life-threatening issues right up front. But you should still go to the emergency department, obviously, if you're hit by lightning.
You know, you should have consulted me for this book, because I actually do have a friend who was struck twice in his life.
No.
You believe it? He's a TV reporter here in Chicago, retired now.
But is it weather?
No, it's not weather.
No? Okay.
Not science, no. But yeah, Paul is,
was
twice. And I don't think either was not ultimately serious, but all that serious. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, try and avoid it if you can. But, you know, things that like feel dangerous, like to me, airplanes are terrifying. I'm like, this seems like a terrible idea. Metal object in the sky, really bumpy. But safest way to travel.
I don't have carbon monoxide detectors in my house, but I do have a canary. Is that good enough?
I think the canary is better than nothing. I will say that the fact that only 14 states require carbon monoxide detectors in hotels, and that it's not something that are in a lot of homes in the United States, is very scary. People assume they have one because you have a smoke detector for fires, but most, I would say like about half, it seems, from my research, don't. And that's crazy, because carbon monoxide, you can't smell it, you can't see it. I mean, you know when your house is on fire eventually, but you can be killed by carbon monoxide in your sleep without a simple $20 detector.
That's Ashley Alker. The name of the book is 99 Ways to Die, and the subtitle is In How to Avoid Them, I think.
Very important.
And we started by talking about your mom and how her health situation got you involved in this, and that she never saw you become a doctor. But you have to imagine that she's very proud of you today.
I hope so. I think she would really have enjoyed all of this. And I think she would have really liked the book. I mean, she wasn't a science person, but like I said, I didn't write this book for science people. I wrote it for everyone else.
Yeah.
And so I hope so, wherever she might be.
It's a wonderful book. It's a wonderful read. I really enjoyed it. And I have to ask, who's the circus performer in your family?
It was my grandmother on my dad's side. My dad's family was kind of, my grandpa was a French lingerie salesman and my grandma was a circus performer on that side. So it's a bit of an eclectic family.
That explains you a little bit, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. I think so too. It's a wild world.
Listen, it was great to talk to you. I wish you the best and I look forward to what's next.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
I've got a pain in my shoulder. Can you see?
Yeah, after this, I'll look at it.
All right, thanks.
Lindholm Roofing has appointments available now to provide you a complete roofing, siding, gutter, and tuck pointing inspection. Call 773-283-7675 or lindholmroofing.com. Tell them that Lou sent you. Lindholm Roofing, their family has your family covered.
You're listening to Steve Bertrand on books. You know, sometimes the worst of us can, well, bring out the best in us, or maybe remind us of the best in us. And that seems to be going on in Minnesota right now. Aaron Brown is with us. He's a columnist for the Minneapolis Star Tribune. Aaron, welcome.
Thanks. Thanks for having me, Steve.
Okay, this is an amazing story to me. I love it. Well, first of all, let me just ask you, how's your state doing?
We're doing okay. I mean, it's been, you know, a consequential winter here in Minnesota, yeah. And a lot of people, you know, I'm fortunate to have not had direct personal connections to anything that happened, but a lot of people had their lives upturned in the federal actions not just in Minneapolis, but across sure. Minnesota. Even I live in rural Minnesota, and there was activity even out here. So I mean, it was a statewide thing, and you know, we're doing okay. You know, the forces are drawing down, but it's still something on everyone's mind.
You know, I'm gonna rephrase what you said a little bit, and I'm interested in what you think. A lot of us didn't have direct impact, but I think we've all had personal impact,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
I think it's been a very personal thing to all
our
of
community.
Us.
It's our community. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And we certainly went through it here in Illinois too, not to the extent that you did, mm-hmm. but Minnesota prevails. I mean, you've had you know, quite a rough mm-hmm. race relations history over the past 10 years, and mm-hmm. But that's the downside. You wrote this column that jumped out at me, and I love the story. It's about a woman named Maude Hart Lovelace, and she wrote a series of books in 1940.
In the 40s and 50s. Yeah, there were 12 of them.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about them.
Well, so Maude Hart Lovelace was a little girl from Mankato, Minnesota, in the southern part of the state. And she grew up wanting to be a writer, which was an odd thing at that time. And sure enough, she became one. And after writing several adult, you know, nonfiction, or I should say historical fiction books, she embarked on a career as a children's author, starting with, they're all called the Betsy Tacy series. It's mm-hmm. two girls, neighbors, Betsy and Tacy, the best of friends, and they grow up together. And each book kind of follows as they get a little older, and the story matures a little bit as they do. And these books were kind of contemporary to Little House on the Prairie, Anne of Green Gables, a lot of these, you know, literature books that a lot of young girls read. But Betsy Tacy, as I say in the column, is kind of like the, you know, if you're lucky, you had someone in your life cool enough to give you the Betsy Tacy books, because they're and I wasn't as I didn't grow up with them, because even though I'm from Minnesota, we read Little House on the Prairie. Everyone did; it was almost required. But Betsy Tacy never really cried. I'm a boy, you know, so that's part of it. When I found out how devoted people were to these books who had been raised with them, it's almost a religious experience for some of the people who read these books. And they're these very simple stories, but they're told in a very the writing is very dynamic and interesting, and these girls are just real. It's even 100 years, these books are set in the early 1900s, so 1901 through the World War I. Their experiences sound real and direct with anyone growing up. And that's a skill of the author, really.
Before we get too far from it, I want to give a nod to your writing, because you talked about, you know, being handed this book. You wrote as if it was a cooler sibling slipped a copy of Velvet Underground under your bed, which I think that's pretty nice. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of like that. That's how Betsy Tacy people see these books. And I know you've got some listeners. There's 90% of the people might not have heard of these books, and then the others that have just had their world rocked by hearing them spoken aloud. That's kind of the way these books are. They're underground children's books, and they're so fun. They're such a, and so I came to them as an adult, and I read Betsy Tacy Go Over the Big Hill for this column, and that's a great one. I just enjoyed it even as an adult, even though it's meant for, you know, 10-year-old, 11-year-old. Right. Kids, just a lovely story, and told in a way that's just, you never quite know what's going to happen next, and it's just the lives of these girls growing up. It's nothing. There's no space aliens. There's no no supernatural events. It's just real life stuff, and it's really cool.
And there's a society of Betsy Tacy fans, or
the Betsy Tacy Society is alive and very well, I learned.
Has it been going through a resurgence given what's going on in Minnesota?
I don't know if it is, but I hope it does, because they do a lot of activity, and they have book discussion groups. People from all over the world are in this thing, and if you know these books, you find your way to the society, you can join in the Zoom book discussions or participate on social media. They really go after them, and everyone's, it's like any we were talking about Bob Dylan before, right. it's like a famous musician, everyone's got their favorite album, and they can discuss it for years on end, and that's what this is too.
Aaron, I don't mean to discredit you, but I tried first to get Bette Midler on, and I couldn't get her. So I
I tried to get Bette Midler too. We both failed in that regard.
I'm reading your column. I was like, wait a minute. Bette Midler is a fan of the Betsy Tacy books. Explain that for me.
Well, this is the lore, and I talked to my friend Heidi, who is one of the people who turned me on to these books. And she knew, like, the lore in Betsy Tacy societies is that Bette Midler is like the matron behind the scenes of the whole thing. She just loves these books, but it's hard to find, particularly from the Midwest, a female author who grew up in the 50s or 60s that didn't cite Betsy Tacy as some kind of influence, just because it was a story about about a young girl who wanted to be a professional writer and knew that from a young age. And sure enough, despite the era in which it was both written and when it was set, it was a world where that was totally accepted, and it was and it became true for her, and evidenced by the books themselves. And so that was something I learned as well. And a number of women authors cite the Betsy Tacy books.
So we're talking, though, because the one of them, the one you wrote about, I think it was Over the Hill or Up and Over the Hill,
yep,
has to do with Syrian immigrants in her town of Mankato. Now, she's writing in the 40s. She's writing about the era of, 1901, 1902 or something
early,
like that?
Very early 1900s.
Yeah. So it has to do with the history of immigration of the country through the history of immigration in Minnesota, and more specifically Mankato. Tell me about that.
Yeah, well, this is why I was attracted to the story, because we hear about immigration and its discussion today, and it almost seems completely alien to the way immigration was seen in the not-so-distant past. And the integral part for a state like Minnesota, though Illinois or any other state would be true, this would be true, in that era from 1900 to really World War II, tremendous amounts of different kinds of immigration made these communities, made these states, and really made the country in so many ways. And in Maud Hart Lovelace's case, Mankato had what was called Syrian community. In fact, it was Lebanon. What is modern-day Lebanon is where these immigrants came from. And they were Christian Lebanese people coming during the political and religious tumult of that time. And so they came to Mankato, and they're still there. In fact, that was one of the things I reveal in the column, is – I actually found a family that's been running a business for more than 100 years in the same neighborhood where these books are set, grocery store. And so third generation, the one of the generations, the father was the mayor of Mankato for 12 years. And that's a true story. That's a real story that almost seems like it fits in the ethos of these old children's, these very inclusive and friendly children's stories. And I think that's just something about our history that's important to remember as we discuss what to do about immigration today, because right now it feels almost an adversarial, even warlike. I mean, obviously, sure. we were just talking a warlike situation over the debate about immigration. But if we can look at the human element, you know, I'm from Hibbing, Minnesota, which, as I point out in the column, was 50% foreign-born in 1915.
We got to get into that because that just astounds me, Aaron, that in Hibbing, Minnesota, mm-hmm. in 1915, 50% foreign-born?
Yeah, yeah. So we're an iron mining region in northern Minnesota, mm-hmm. and 43 ethnic groups from mostly European, but nevertheless foreign-born, mostly non-English-speaking, a large Catholic population that came into what had been a Protestant area, Protestant state. And so all of the growing pains and challenges of immigration were front and center in a community like that. And most of what we're talking about today, and the debate and the rhetoric used today is something that was handled 100 years ago in many ways by the communities of that time. Sufficient that, just like this Lebanese American family in Mankato, you know, my community in northern Minnesota, there's foreign names on mayors and city councils and businesses left and right. Everybody's an American, though, and that's what happens two or three generations later, and that's part of the story we miss.
Was Maud trying to set things right when she wrote this book, or was it just happened to be how she grew up? Or it's not a very eloquently asked question, but I think you know what I'm
I do. Yeah. So actually the best feature of these books is that I don't believe Maud Hart Lovelace is trying to send a special message. It's not a very special, you know, like a Saturday morning cartoon, very special episode that tries to teach you not to do drugs or to be accepting of others. It just is that way because that's how her parents were. Her parents were really kind of eccentric, but also just very loving, welcoming people who raised their daughters that way. And the friends were that way for real. And so she just was sharing that experience that she had meeting the new people and becoming friends with them, in as a real story, just as something that happened. It doesn't gloss over the fact that there were voices in the community that were very distrustful of the new people, very mean to the people who came, just like you might expect. But basically, once these families were accepted in the community, you know, they just continue being members of the story.
That's who we are, right?
Yeah,
that's what this country is.
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
I grew up in a town about an hour south of Chicago, and there's a Catholic church there named St. George. It's a town, but it's really just a flat piece of asphalt. But if you go behind the church, every name in the cemetery is French. Mm-hmm. Every name is French. Bertrand is my last name. And, mm-hmm. You know, that's how we founded and that's how we prospered. And you kind of touch on that in your piece as well.
Yeah. Well, I mean, my story is American mutt. You know, most of my ancestors weren't here in 1900. They were somewhere else. Mm-hmm. You know, so like I said, I have a last name of Brown. That's an English name, but it's a mostly Nordic bloodline mixed with a lot of German. And then along the way, some of us married Italians. And so there's Italian food on the plate every Sunday.
Yeah.
My great aunt, a very Norwegian great aunt, married an Italian Leo Fraboni, who was the sausage king of northern Minnesota. And so we had a Fraboni sausage porchetta in the family feast every Sunday growing up. And so this kind of cross-cultural food is a big part of it. Song, tradition, another part of my family's Finnish. So saunas and the steam bath and all of the traditions that go with that are part of our lives. And that's just how America is. There's a lot of things that are really immigrant stories that just become American stories. We just forgot where they came from.
Let's take ICE out of it and Border Patrol mm-hmm. out of it. Before all of that started, was Maud's Minnesota of 1901 through 1940 the same as Minnesota today, or have there been more conflict before the federal government came in?
Well, there was certainly less federal involvement. There was no federal involvement, really. And while the rhetoric that you hear today, anti-immigrant rhetoric, fear, economic fears, cultural fears, fears of crime taking off because of this unsavory element, that was all present in the community. And she actually doesn't gloss that over. That's in the stories as well. But it wasn't the only voice, and it wasn't, in the end, the dominant voice, mm-hmm. because ultimately, when people came and wanted to start businesses and wanted to prove themselves, and when the kids went to school and learned English and became integrated into the community, people realized that, you know, this makes us stronger. This makes our communities better. And it showed up in places like the Iron Range, where I'm from. It shows up in a lot of communities all over the country where this happens. It's hard at first because we don't understand each other, but in a generation or two, the fruits are ripe. You know, people are part of the community, and things have grown and developed into a really rich and strong thing.
I would imagine, I'm just thinking, she was writing these in the 40s. It's a precursor, really, to the civil rights movement, but mm-hmm. To the spark of the civil rights movement. Certainly not to the negative activities that led to that spark. Right. So she had an audience in 1940 and 1945, reading about 1901, that probably was looking for the same messages. I'm thinking, Aaron, of Mr. Rogers taking off the black mailman shoes, there's an episode similar to that.
That's right. Yeah, in sharing a wading pool with.
That's what it was. Right, cooling off his feet. Yeah.
Yep, with the police officer, I believe.
And okay.
Yeah, and absolutely, it was. I don't think she was trying to be overhanded about it, but she was very conscious and aware of the refugee climate after World War II, and there are elements in the later books that talk about people moving because they had to move. And so there's, this was something that was contemporary to her writing that probably was on her mind a little bit, that might have brought her back to her upbringing in the 1900s and teens, where these immigration stories were happening.
It's just lovely that mm-hmm. that such a story, I don't want to say hibernated, to come to life this year, because Bette Midler and Anna Quinlan and others have been fostering the flames.
The Betsy Tacy people have not left. They've been here the whole time, believe me. But if you haven't, and if you're looking for something interesting for your grandkids or your kids or grandkids, then you want to try something classic that's maybe not as well known, check out these Betsy Tacy books. The first ones start out at a very elementary reading level so that the kids can learn to read along. But then as the girls get older, they become basically YA literature, and they deal with more mature topics, you know, heavier things that kids would be thinking about as they got older.
It's Betsy Tacy, T-A-C-Y, and those are two girls, right? Two
different
friends.
Girls, Betsy and Tacy, and then Tib, their friend Tib, joins in later, and then there's every book builds on the next one. There's new characters that enter, and they just hang around as part of the story.
The author is Marred Hart Loveless, and did any of her work show up in any of Bob Dylan's work?
I don't know. I've never heard of it, but
he might have been almost contemporary to the books, right?
Yeah, he grew up in Hibbing in the 40s, the late 40s and early 50s. He graduated 59 from Hibbing High School. So, yeah, those books would have been out at that time. I don't know. He could have read them or would have known people who did.
There aren't many people in Hibbing. You must know Bob Dylan, right?
Yeah. Well, I know people. I know a distant cousin, and the coolest thing I think is I knew quite well before he passed Bob Dylan's English teacher, B.J. Rolfson, and I had a lot of conversations with him, the man who taught Dylan poetry, and he was a big influence on Dylan, and so I got to hear some of the things he taught and kind of get the idea of how that shaped Bob Dylan, so that was pretty cool.
As long as we're talking about writing, right? And you're an historian?
Yeah, as well as a columnist, yeah.
So what are you working on now?
I'm working on a book about a mayor of Hibbing, Victor L. Power, who fought the world's biggest corporation, U.S. Steel, in this same period, 19-teens and 20s. And he actually defeated the biggest corporation for a period. He was able to tax the corporation to build this beautiful city, this beautiful high school in the middle of the mud and stumps of a deforested northern Minnesota, and then encountered challenges like prohibition and of course immigration was a big story, and he actually ended up in conflict with an early or an iteation of the Ku Klux Klan at the end of his life. So
history is all around us, isn't it?
It's history converges in this little place, and Minnesota's got a lot of places like that. We're a very moralistic state. We get into scraps like this. We're not afraid of it.
That's good. And you know, you showed that with the crowds at the Somali restaurants and all of that. And well, listen, next time I see you, I'll bring a covered dish so you feel at home.
Thank you. There better be tater tots in there.
Is tater tots a staple?
Tater tot hot dish, yeah.
All right. Okay. Yeah. Tater tots would be on the bottom or the top, right?
Yeah.
Aaron Brown.
Both, columnist, maybe.
Columnist for the Star Tribune. You can find him, give him a search, and read more about the Betsy Tacy books. It's just a great story. I'm so glad you picked up on it because, again, Bet's not returning my calls, so it was you or no one. And I think we're all better off for it.
Yep, she's the distant power in the Betsy Tacy world, so maybe she'll come down and visit us one of these days.
Hey, I wish you best of luck. And
thanks a lot, Steve.
Go Bears. Say that for me.
Nope, not today.
That's Minneapolis Star Tribune columnist Aaron Brown. And don't forget to check out Ashley Alker's 99 Ways to Die and How to Avoid Them. It's killer funny. Thanks very much for listening this week. I hope you enjoyed our stories. And I hope you'll subscribe to Steve Bertrand on Books at Spotify or on the podcast app on your iPhone. And, of course, at WGNradio.com. What do you think? Love to hear from you. SteveBertrandOnBooks@gmail.com. That's going to wrap things up for this week. Until next week, be well.